But the project began with a notion to attempt and capture the past and trying to grab and then shed some light on the evolution of Memphis barbecue through the voices of pitmasters. And I use the word pitmasters very specifically because that's what we wanted. We didn't want initially restaurateurs or the financing or the money behind restaurants. We wanted it in the voice of the folks who cook. We set forth to preserve as many of these old voices as we could possibly find. They were mostly men, and we wanted, again, the folks who had worked through the movement of Memphis barbecue from family food through saleable commodity to food that is now shipped globally around the world. Got into it a little bit, and sadly, I think we came to our idea a little later than we would have liked. When you start making your telephone calls, you start asking around, you start doing your research, you find that many old pitmasters have passed. In some cases, they're living, but their memories are beyond reliable recall and narration. As one family member I spoke to when I was talking to him about interviewing, his father said, "I'd let you talk to him, but I just don't know what he'd say." So capturing the old voice became a little bit more difficult than we had anticipated. As in any case, as in any research you do, you work with what's before you. So we ended up listening not just to the voices of the pitmasters, but also to the voices of restaurateurs. Because as I found, those people were as important. Sometimes they were pitmasters, sometimes they weren't. But the voices of the restaurateurs and those who dreamed and gambled and conceptualized, shaped, and commercially packaged the flavor of Memphis barbecue. Quickly, what thematic themes emerge from this quilting of voices? Commercial Memphis barbecue early in the 40s grew in parallel worlds. The parallel worlds of segregation. In Memphis alone, you had the Hawkins Grill, which was, as one interviewer related to me, black barbecue. And then just blocks away, Leonard's Barbecue, the home of James Willis, served largely white patrons. And black patrons were relegated through doing their business through the back and through the kitchen door. Another theme that comes up is that barbecue is a business. As much as it's romanticized, as much as we talk about its lore, it's the dreams of entrepreneurs. Their dreams and their restaurants, even the chain restaurants, come in different shapes and sizes. No cook or owner or founder opens a business to go out of business. Every single one of them was patently clear about this. Everyone wants to be successful, and efficiency and compromise become functions in economic equations. Hence, we have the rise of Southern pride and old hickory ovens, professionally bottled sauces, and professionally mixed and profiled spices. It would also be remiss in all of this to fail to note the effect of the car. Mr. Willis, as I'll tell you in a minute, started picking trays. The barbecue restaurant was a drive-in, and people could come pick their sandwiches up. The desire to be efficient, successful, and control quality and costs more than anything else propelled barbecue from artisan to professional, which brings me to James Willis, a consummate professional who has maintained the human and artisanal elements in his professional food. As Mr. Willis noted in our conversation, I don't think anybody in Memphis is cooking barbecue like they cooked it in 40, 48, or 50, even 70, maybe 60, because they're getting away from that labor. For Mr. Willis, barbecue is a love of labor. Mr. Willis has been tending the pits at Leonard's Barbecue since 1940. He actually, as I mentioned earlier, started picking trays in 1938 as part of drive-in style service. He began cooking shoulders overnight before gas-fired and electronically controlled ovens that you set, go home, come back in the morning, and the meat's done. In Mr. Willis' day, the fires required continual overnight tending for temperature and flame control. The shoulders had to be unburned and properly cooked for service the next day. As he explained to me also, overnight cooks provided the benefit of a night watchman. Mr. Willis has outlasted expansion, contraction, segregation, and shortcuts. At age 79, he still comes into Leonard's every Thursday. He tells me he enjoys the camaraderie with the other cooks and speaks of the kitchen as family. As someone who's eaten his food, he knows how to cook. The quality of his food brings Mr. Willis calls from all over the country seeking barbecue and/or his service. Most importantly, if you get the chance today, talk and listen to James Willis. He has worked, perhaps labored is a better word, through the growth and explosion of Memphis barbecue. He can tell of the ways that food used to be handled, how seasoning has changed, how during segregation food and custom cooking for black patrons again occurred through the back door of a kitchen, and his family were not even allowed in the front door of the restaurant where he cooked. But James Willis also made a life among and from his food. He can also tell you of the great success from his work. Barbecue brought him the ability to raise a successful family. He loves his kids. He tells me all about it. This weekend and today with James Willis here, we are all wise to ask, listen, and commit to memory. And before I present his award, one last note. Mr. Willis says, it's the sauce. So, from 1938 to 2002, and the production of wonderful barbecue, and the maintenance of personal standards in barbecue, and the personal handling of food, even in the push for mass efficiency and low costs in modern food production, we present the Keeper of the Flame Award this year to James Willis of Leonard's Barbecue.
About 55 or 56 years. And at one time, we would block the streets at Bellevue and Macklemore for the folks to come in and eat. And we would cook from 75 to 150 pounds of meat. From 75 to 150 shoulders a day. Shoulders. Not no pounds, shoulders. Every night for 7 nights a week. And we had. But if you cook and I cook, and we cooking barbecue now. I run out, you run out. At your place, if you got business, I can carry some of my barbecue to you. And you put your sauce on it. And people never know the difference. So that's when I said 85 or 80%. Of barbecue is the sauce, and you got to cook it slow. Now don't go there and try to work up some rational barbecue. You can't do that. And you have to try to keep it at a certain temperature. I mean that as we cook with charcoal, you know, and we scatter it under there, and heat would rise up to 350. And then when that goes down to 160, 100, we put some more under there. Let it rise back up. So that's what you got to do with that barbecue. You got to cook it slow and have a good sauce. And I thank y'all.
Thank y'all so much for making the trip down to Memphis. We're honored y'all could come. Our next speaker, Dr. Ray Oldenburg, did his graduate training in sociology at the University of Minnesota. He has held positions in the state university systems of Minnesota, Wisconsin, Nevada, and Florida, teaching a full spectrum of sociology courses and spending several years as department chair. His areas of specialization are community and public life. He has traveled extensively and of late has done quite a bit of consulting on such areas. Dr. Oldenburg has over 50 publications. His most recent book is an edited collection entitled Celebrating the Third Place. The book I Know and Love, in addition to that one, I got that one for Christmas last year. The way I came to know Dr. Oldenburg's book and the way many of you, Dr. Oldenburg's work and the way many of you may know it, is through the book The Great Good Place, which appeared in 1989 and is in a third edition at present. He is a professor emeritus at the University of West Florida in Pensacola, and we welcome him to the Southern Foodway Symposium. Thank you, Dr. Oldenburg.
Thank you, John. Gee, isn't that what the saloon girl called the sheriff in Rio Bravo? Okay, that's why you got it, I guess. Well, this has been terrific. Everybody is attentive. Everybody is awake. Nobody has stood up and insisted we say pit person. Is this really a university campus? As to what we've been eating, I would say certainly that the flavor factories up in New Jersey are going to be awfully hard-pressed. Now, before I get into the more serious note, I've got three items about barbecue that two of them are things we shouldn't do, one that works, unfortunately, all too well. The first has to do with a technique of barbecuing that has not been mentioned here. I live in one of those places that Kenneth Jackson had in mind when he said, or when he wrote, "There's nothing so desolate on this earth as a suburban sidewalk on a Sunday afternoon." That fits us pretty well, except that the other days of the week are just the same. So, one time some years ago, the word went out in the neighborhood that we were going to have a cookout. And I thought, well, that's wonderful because I don't know most of my neighbors. And then I asked, who's going to do it? Well, my friend said, well, a fellow up the street has learned this technique. It's great. He learned it in the Philippines. I said, what's that? He said, well, he puts the pig in a wooden crate, and then he starts the crate afire, and when it's all burned up, we have this wonderful pig. That was the only attempt at a neighborhood cookout we've ever had. Nobody has ever mentioned it again. Beware of Filipinos bearing wood crates. The other thing I didn't witness myself, but a friend of mine was driving through rural Alabama one day, and he came upon a UBQ. You've probably never heard of it, and for good reason. The guy, an enterprising fellow in the more remote area, thought he had a business going. He would provide grills and a pit and a few park benches. You brought everything else, including briquettes or wood or whatever, all the stuff you wanted to eat and so on and so forth. UBQ. So there'll never be a franchise with UBQ. It was a dismal failure. Now the successful thing, and you may have heard of this. For years, my wife and I belonged to something called a gourmet club, which was a misnomer, of course. We weren't all that good at cooking. The high point of this was the last meal of the year, which was done at poolside, and we found somebody competent who could genuinely barbecue a suckling pig for us. And then we had a nice chest full of frozen daiquiris. And this was just wonderful. And at the very end, we'd pick up those last little pieces, those little orcs of this delicious stuff, wishing there were more. Well, my oldest daughter married a gentleman in the food business. And early in his career, he was the food manager of a very large Holiday Inn. And I told him about, we talk a lot about food and cigars and drinks and so on. Anyway, he's a nice chap. And so I told him about these episodes. He said, well, I've served, a lot of suckling pig, and we never run out. I said, how do you manage that? Well, here's how he did it. And some of you are probably familiar with this and don't want to admit it. The suckling pig comes out on this table with wheels, this cart, and it's got a curtain around it. And it's got a shelf down there, and on that shelf are two well-cooked Boston butts. Do you see where we're going? They never run out of suckling pig. All it takes is a guy who knows when to lift down, reach down there, and put a little more up. Learned a lot from him. Learned also that the drink we call a martini is a fake. Absolute fake. His bartenders would get all sorts of criticisms. Put too much vermouth in this thing. And they don't like criticism more than anybody else does. So what my son-in-law would tell him is, give him straight gin, drop an olive in. Works like a charm. Works like a charm. Okay, that's the unserious incidentals. My mission in life turned out to be that of getting the concept of the third place as part of the American vocabulary. For those of you not familiar with it, third places are informal public gathering places, which are not for everybody a third place, but if you have such a place that you visit regularly, then for you it is a third place. It's your connection to community. I like to think of it as offering that balance, that support, that stability that a tripod gives. The first place is the home, the most important place of all. The second place is the work lot, which pays for everything. And the third place, which many don't have, which many more used to have in this country, is that third place. Here is where you meet all sorts of interesting people and get to know them quite well. They are not usually, most of them are not welcome in your home, nor would they feel comfortable in your home, but these relationships are very important. This importance has most recently been stressed by Robert Putnam in the book Bowling Alone, which I suppose most of you have heard of. Now, the third place, in the usual case, in the most successful cases, have been local, independent business operations that we invade if they're nice places for us. We simply take them over. Recently, I read a book by a man named Wilkinson on the Japanese economy. And I found in that book, this was published in 1980, I found in that book that in Japan, 57% of all retail as of 1980 was mom and pop, local independent businessmen. They have a much stronger lobby there than they do here. In 1980 in the United States, local independent retailers accounted for but 3%. Well, where's all that business going? Well, you know where it's going. It's going to the franchise operations. And the franchise operations, generally speaking, Mr. Schultz and his Starbucks aside, notwithstanding, are not third places. They are not mixers. The range of permissible behavior is as limited as the bill of fare, which is the case with almost all of these places. First Amendment rights are not exercised there, but they're taking over. Now, one of the reasons, and perhaps the major reason, they've been able to take over is because our government, our municipal governments particularly, have obliged them with restrictive zoning laws. Now, you couldn't have a McDonald's in every city block, and you know why. The volume of business wouldn't support it. So you need, then, territory in which people are forced to get into their cars, drive out to the collector roads, go down to the malls, go down, out to the strips, and go to these franchise places. And when you're there, you're so far from home, by the way, that you're not among friends. In the old days, when the American Tavern was in its heyday, 80% of the trade came from within a two block radius. And in the Five and Dimes of that day, you had these comic things about the drunk staggering home and leaning against the lamppost and so on and so forth. But that inebriate could walk home because it was close by, because the tavern was in the neighborhood. Now they do their staggering behind a wheel, and it's very upsetting, as it should be. In the period just after the end of World War II, we had in this country over 152,000 taverns, in the sense of no food, just, well, maybe potato chips and pickled pig's feet behind the bar and so on. But and nowadays, there are fewer, we have lost over two-thirds of them. They're not allowed where people live anymore, nor indeed is anything else. The, the public life for the vast middle class of American society is almost devoid of any content. The places aren't there. We don't even have sidewalks in many of these subdivisions because there's nothing to walk to. So, I don't want to belabor this point. I can usually depress an audience within 10 minutes very, very deeply. It takes you 2 weeks to get over it sometimes. The point that's becoming, that more people are picking up on these days, I'll give you a quotation from John Dewey that expresses this, I think, quite well. Dewey wrote at one time, he said, I'm inclined to believe that the heart and final guarantee of democracy is in the free gatherings of neighbors on the street corners to discuss back and forth and converse freely with one another. Other writers have made the same point. Democracy is more social than it is political. We've got to have these gathering places. Where would the civil rights movement be if it hadn't been for the fact that of the black churches? As Wolfgang Schimmelbusch, it took an outlander to figure this out, that there wouldn't be such a thing. There would not be such a thing as labor solidarity if it hadn't been for beer and the places in which they could drink it. If you look at the history of the French, and the French are very antagonistic to voluntary associations and usually in their past have outlawed labor unions. Yet the French workers staged many successful strikes. Why were they able to do this? How could they get together? Well, they had the cafes. So these gathering places are of vital importance. Tiananmen Square, does that ring a bell? Mothers in New York City who met on their children's playground, but at least had a place to meet, and were on occasion able to stop Robert Moses and his bulldozers. These places are essential. So I offer a challenge then to barbecue aficionados. There's a couple of things I think that you might want to be concerned about. Recently in my hometown of Pensacola, there was a competition to build upscale housing in an area that had been public housing. The whole thing had been raised and leveled and et cetera, et cetera. And I reviewed three proposals from three different developers, what they would build. Each of them had a green out there. I asked in each case, what's that for? They really didn't know. It's just, I guess we gotta have this green spot here, you know, this reminiscent of the old town square or green or whatever. Well, again, commercial is zoned out. But I got to thinking, I was in Washington, D.C. one time during a holiday, and I thought, my God, Pennsylvania Avenue is a fire. What's going on? And, of course, it was the Cookers. That's what they do. And I thought, my, this is marvelous. If on those greens you could have a barbecue, and people could actually get together and get to know one another. And think of that smoke going up, that's the signal. What do you need? I mean, it's perfect. So maybe we need, there's a fellow who hails from my home state of Minnesota called Gino Pelucci. Gino's Pizza and other things. And Gino had a friend, Pete the Plumber. And Pete the Plumber, for Gino's sake, built an elaborate barbecue cooker, mainly stainless steel, on the chassis of an Oldsmobile Toronado. And when Gino expanded down into Central Florida, Pete would get a call now and then, bring her down, I'm entertaining. And Gino is a sharp fellow, and he would impress and captivate and otherwise ingratiate himself with people through the means or media of the barbecue, and it always worked, and it worked wonderfully. So there's that. How to get barbecue introduced into these lifeless subdivisions? And again, see, the zoning has to do with the structures. Now, of course, there are problems there. Because a lot of these places, I would submit, you probably can't get anything done. We have 30,000 gated communities in the United States with another 30,000 gated communities yet to be built. And typically you have an 85-page rule book. You can't have a cardinal painted on your mailbox. You can't leave your garage door open for more than 3 hours. You can't have more than two colors on your house, and they must both be earth tones, et cetera, et cetera. 85 pages of this. And then if you get an ex-military officer as president of the Homeowners Association, you're not going to get a barbecue or anything else in there. But I assume there are a lot of places where this might be a welcome idea. Another challenge is this. John T. made mention of the book that his wife got him for Christmas, the Celebrating the Third Place. And there are some wonderful places written about there. And some of them, quite a few of them, are gone. Joyce Goldstein's Square One in California. Joyce, I think, gave it about 10 years. Walked probably 30 miles a day on the job. Stayed there till 11, six nights a week. Burned out. The best Republican I ever knew, Richard Knight III, had a place in Troy, New York. The tax structure finally wore him down. He wanted a changing of the guard. He wanted to pass that on to another fine innkeeper. No such luck. A couple of ditzy types bought it, and he was disappointed, of course. Annie Cheatham, who ran this wonderful nursery plant nursery and gift shop, which was a highly successful, lovable place in Amherst, outside of Amherst, burned out after about a dozen years. And so in that book, Planks Cafe in Columbus, Ohio, and by the way, they don't know about barbecue, but they sure know about wet beef. But we won't talk about wet beef because that doesn't have the potential. We could talk about Pittsburgh and its pierogies. They're wonderful, and you can't run a tavern in Pittsburgh without serving pierogies. And you can go over to Cincinnati, and they have Geta. And I'm sure one day there will be competitions with good Geta recipes and so on and so forth. But nothing has, these things are not in the same league, certainly, as barbecue. So, I'd like to have you give some serious thought to this. How do you, assuming you get a good barbecue place, what can be done to ensure its longevity? It really is painful to see good places have to depend so much upon one individual, which they always do. The old wisdom says that, tell me who the proprietor is and I'll tell you who the customers are going to be and how they're going to enjoy it. That's true. But this problem I speak to, this need for good places, is serious enough that I worry about how to keep these places alive. as to the interesting question that was raised before, what shall we call barbecue? I don't know if any studies are done. Have the yuppies picked up on this? Because they're taste nuts. When I first got into this, I began watching McDonald's. Remember, over 2 billion served, and they haven't made a good one yet. When they first hit the scene, I said to myself, they're going to fail. And I know why they're going to fail, because where I came from, if you couldn't get a hamburger smothered in raw and fried onions, you wouldn't buy it. McDonald's could never be bothered to do that, but they succeeded anyway. And then, of course, here's one of the sadder ones. In 1910, in the United States, we had over 100,000 of the best third places, I like to say, that we ever had. And that was the drugstore soda fountain. It was the best to me because it was the most inclusive. Children were welcome, retired people, working people, men and women, nobody had special seating. And you had this wonderful array of sweets. Then along came Dairy Queen, a cheap cinder block building with a little sliding glass window, and that was it. You got this thing. You could get it dipped in chocolate, maybe, or butterscotch or whatever, but basically that was it. And I predicted that it'll never go. So when I wrote The Great Good Place, I really wanted to talk about American taste. And I didn't know what to say about it. And if you really don't know what to say about something, it's best shut up. And now I think taste is becoming more and more important. I'll tell you quite frankly, I never order or buy pork chops anymore. Very simple, too damn dry. They are too dry. So maybe that's another challenge. Although I don't know of any barbecue that is bad because of that dry pork, but certainly the other forms of pork are far less desirable than they used to be. Well, let's have a few questions, if there are any. I know we've had a long day and a lot of waiting and so on. Yes.
It seems to me that Howard Schultz is trying to franchise the third place by making Starbucks that goal, and there are, at least in Seattle, other companies that looked for where they placed and then they duplicated. And that's their marketing technique. And I noticed in Oxford 2 years ago, there is a new coffee place that is could have been a Starbucks. But it's succeeding. If you ignore the coffee, people are in fact doing what I get. I didn't know you invented the term, but Howard Schultz was sure franchising it.
Oh yeah.
What is the? Could barbecue ever compete with a coffee place? I mean, at least currently, as a third place.
Yeah. It would. What it would take is more space and an expanded bill of fare. A remarkable thing has happened in New Zealand. I call it the New Zealand paradox. Can you believe that in the major cities of New Zealand, they have doubled the number of liquor licenses and the consumption of alcohol has decreased? Wow, how do you do that? Well, you change the liquor laws. You say, to get a license, you have to show us your bill of fare. And you have to, beyond that, you have to have some high-grade, non-alcoholic beverages. And it's those high-grade, non-alcoholic beverages that more than compensate the loss of sales from the liquor. It wasn't, I thought at first, my God, how can they produce politicians that wise? Nothing in my experience suggests that politicians are ever that wise. Two things happened. One, in the last couple of decades, New Zealanders have traveled abroad far more than they used to. And wherever they went, they found better stuff than they had at home, and they started to make noise about it. The other thing is that increasingly women went into business, and they liked to have nice places to take clients and colleagues for a drink and so on at lunchtime. And that combination of factors caused them to change the way they do things. Again, if you look carefully at the franchise places generally, a kind of behavior allowed, permissible, is as narrow as the bill of fare, and you really can't do much. I never saw anybody playing cards in Starbucks.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
They're playing cards,
and they're playing cards. They're doing their homework. The college students are doing their homework. Business people are meeting there.
Okay, that's second generation Starbucks. They've caught onto this. They've caught onto this this business of the long stay customer. Yeah, and they do really mean to take over. I look at shopping malls, you know, and I say, Jesus, that strip of grass there, it'd be wonderful for horseshoes. You'll never see anybody playing horseshoes there. One of my favorite towns, I have a hard time traveling the interstate, so when I go north all by myself, there's this little town of Traer, Iowa. Iowa is a strange state. They have wonderful small towns, and then there's Des Moines, which is the biggest disaster of a city I've ever been in. I don't know why it is, but anyway, in Traer at the Sunnyside Tap, you go in there between 9 and 10 in the morning, and there's a big card table, and there's 6 to 8 fellas playing cards, and they don't spend a dime. And the proprietor's happy with that, they're happy with it, but that's not the way that franchise operations. They want high volume, fast turnover, uncomfortable seating. They're rude to you if you don't know your order when you step up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Other questions?